Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
Welcome to episode 12 of Nerd Pride Radio. 12? It's one less than a baker's dozen. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I'm awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I'm a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, a computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that I just can't fit in my brain anymore. By the way, as of last week, we are officially the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right, apparently, Nerd Pride smells like the inside of a static-free Mylar bag. Congratulations to us. But let's get right into some feedback. This first one I actually got as a comment on the Nerd Pride Radio blog portion of the site, and it is from a listener named Daz, who is not on our boards. And it starts off, Mike, loving the podcast, and was a former fanboy of the Animal Cast, my previous podcast before this one. I miss Kyle, though. You guys were a great team. Hey, I miss Kyle, too, but unfortunately, he got lost on a hiking trek through the Andes, and we haven't heard from him since. So maybe one day. Come back to us, Kyle. Anyway, Daz continues. Some points. This one for the Mike Was Wrong segment. Oh, crap. Let me cue up the music.
Everything right is wrong again.
That's right. Daz has brought us to yet another installment of our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong. And Daz tells me, yeah, the Manx language is from the Isle of Man, not the Isle of Wight. Oh, I knew that! I knew that! I'm an idiot! Okay. Yes, Isle of Man. All right, thank you. Anyway, back to our feedback. Daz continues. And if you want to talk about some real weird languages in the British Isles, try Ulster Scots, spoken very rarely in the Northern Ireland area, and thought to be a dialect from the Scottish settlers who arrived there in the 17th century, derived from Scots. Okay, let me break into your feedback again for a second here. Holy cow! You just sent me right back down the Wikipedia rabbit hole again. I appreciate that. I went to go look up Ulster Scots, and apparently the move to push Ulster Scots right now in Northern Ireland as part of their cultural identity, this is a reaction to the Irish language movement. And it turns out that this whole thing is all part of the big Northern Ireland fight that's been going on forever. You know, Protestants versus Catholics, British Unionists versus the independent Irish movement, and now apparently Ulster Scots versus the Irish language itself. So there you go. Thanks, Daz. I appreciate that little trip. So there you go. And I followed Wikipedia for a long time after that, but I'm not gonna go too far into it. But I appreciate the trip, Daz, because I learned a lot, and that's what counts. Anyway, Daz's letter continues. You mentioned anime in episode 10. Here's one for you. Try Morabito. Morabito. It's an Eastern-style fantasy, but not Wuxia. I don't know what Wuxia means, or anything. If D&D had been developed in Japan, this would be the anime that sums it up. Stick with it as the story builds wonderfully. My daughters love it. Also recommend Bamboo Blade, which is about an all-girl kendo team. Again, my daughter's pick. They insist that you have to watch. Okay, well, you know what, Daz? I will take a look at that, and I will find out, because I've put a few things on my list. I've tried the first two episodes of Gunslinger Girl based on some recommendations from the boards, and I'm not feeling that one yet. I'm going to try Full Metal Alchemist next, and then I will add yours to my list, and I will give them a fair shot. My one son, Atayan, his opinion on it is that I'm simply not watching them long enough. He feels like I have this visceral gut reaction that kind of rejects anime automatically. And so I'm not giving it long enough to get past that. A lot of them have stories that develop and that I really need to sit down and watch a few episodes. You know, give it, for a typical show, if I watch four episodes, that's going to give me over an hour and a half. That should be, as much as a good movie, right? So he's telling me I should get a few episodes in and then see how I feel about them. So, all right, I'm going to try. I'm not feeling it yet, but darn it, I'm going to like anime one of these days, I promise you. Daz also doesn't give me a fancy send-off to his letter, but he does give me some Podomatic suggestions, so I've added those to the list. Maybe they'll come up today, maybe they won't. My next letter comes from Scree, and Scree writes in, and he's not actually commenting on the podcast, but I'm going to share his letter anyway. Scree says, "Officially, I am a full-blooded Mandalorian. Booyah! Found out today. May I live out the Rezolnare? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. May my clan prosper. Booyah!" That was actually such good news for him, it deserved two booyahs. So, congratulations, Scree. I have no idea what any of that means. So, I went to go look it up, and as it turns out, the Wookiepedia rabbit hole runs just as deep as Wikipedia, and it took me forever to drag myself out of there. But to give you the quick sum up, Mandalorian is a people within the Star Wars universe? Of course it is. And it is the people from which Jango Fett and Boba Fett come. They are Mandalorians themselves. To which I say, wait a minute, aren't Boba Fett and Jango Fett humans? And as it turns out, they are. While the Mandalorian people started off as the Tonga race, I think. I don't remember. Anyway, almost all of them died out, but their culture continued. And now you can be Mandalorian and be pretty much any species as long as you follow the Mandalorian code, the Rezolnare, the six basic tenets of Mandalorian life. One of which, by the way, is that you have to own your own armor and wear it regularly. You have to speak Mandalorian. And then there's some other code of honor stuff. But those were the two that stuck out in my head. So actually, as it turns out, while this is all out of Star Wars, so it's all fictional, technically, by the rules of the Mandalorian people, if you follow the Rezolnare, you're accepted, you can actually become a Mandalorian despite the fact that it is fictional. So, good on ya. Congratulations to Scree. This was just fascinating. Like I say, you ever want to go get lost in a good wiki? Go look up Wikipedia. Or even, also, the Alpha Prime, I think is the name of the Star Trek Wikipedia. Oh, Jesus, these things will take you, they will take you deep into stuff that you didn't even, you can consider yourself a huge fan, you really can, and you're still going to find stuff that you go, really? I had no idea. And I'm not, by any means, a fanatic about either Star Wars or Star Trek. I am a fan of both, I enjoy them both, but there are people far more devoted than I am, but no matter who you are, just interesting stuff. So thank you, Scree. Appreciate the feedback. Let's see, more feedback? Oh my gosh, more feedback. This is from the forums. This is actually the comment thread for episode 11. Serious Paul chimes in and says, "Yeah, you lost me at the Boy Scout dress-up thing." All right, I know. It's not for everybody. All right, I get it. But I love my kids. I love my Boy Scouts. I love what I do. And, that's actually one of the magic things about the new format here at Nerd Pride Radio is my segments are really never more than about 5 minutes long, maybe 10 if I'm really pushing it. So if you don't like it, I got more good stuff coming right around the corner. And speaking of which, my brother Kyle says, "Dude, Gypsy Punk was awesome. I need more of that." Yeah, seriously, look up Gogol Bordello. I don't know of any other Gypsy Punk bands, but look them up because it's all like that. All right, and they're fun and they're energetic and you really want to listen to this stuff. It is great. Is great stuff to mix into the rest of your music. You love Gogol Bordello. But Kyle also continues, "And yes, I never want to hear you speak of musicals again. But I recognize it's my personal preference and others may actually enjoy hearing such nonsense." Yeah, well, strangely, it just occurred to me, I had a sarcastic comment to make about this, but it just occurred to me that Kyle, you were lost in the Andes. How are you getting email out? Dude, seriously, if you can hear the podcast, come home. Your eight children miss you. We need you. Okay. Also from the feedback, that same thread in the episode 11 commentary, Stan and Talvin both chimed in about the music. Apparently, my punk rock went over well. And Stan recommended a band, a Finnish metal band called Korpiklaani. is the name of it, which translates as Forest Clan. And they are a Finnish metal band that mixes in Finnish folk music using an accordion and a violin, and they are really good. I took a listen to that stuff, and I'm going to be buying a couple of their songs because they are really awesome. And Talvin recommended Prydain, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Go check the thread if you want to follow the link. But it is a Scottish bagpipe rock band, and one of their most popular songs is they do Stairway to Scotland, which includes Amazing Grace, and as I said in the thread there, you cannot do justice to Amazing Grace without a bagpipe, in my opinion. I absolutely love the song, and the link that he followed, I don't even know the name of the song, but I listened to two or three things by Prydain and really like them. That bagpipe rock is actually just up my alley. So, anyway, enough feedback. Let's head right into the master list. This is the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast, and this is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting, I add it to this master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out onto you every week when I record, you lucky dogs. The first thing up is our science fiction double feature. Science fiction double feature. That's right. Here at Nerd Pride Radio, you get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low price. By the way, you guys can't see it, but as I do these standard intro things, I have hand gestures that go with them, and I do the same sort of thing every time. I wish you could see it, because I am funny. Anyway, our first movie review this week is X-Men First Class, because A, it's a superhero movie, and B, it comes from Marvel, which means it's awesome. Holy cow. And I know it's been out for a while, but I just got it on Netflix. So you have to deal with it. I'm always a little behind the times when it comes to doing movie reviews, TV reviews. It's just the way I work. X-Men First Class was just hands down a spectacular movie. All right, first off, they put so much into this story with character development and real motivation while still remaining true to the basics of what the X-Men are about, and not messing up continuity for the other films. Because, all right, look, I loved the first X-Men movie. It was great, all right? But the first X-Men movie also had to be an origin story because that's just how they do superhero franchises anymore. And they took too long on the origin stuff. I mean, it was a great movie. I enjoyed it beginning to end, really did. But it was mostly origin stuff. And then X-Men 2, okay, good. We've gotten through all that character, you know, the origin stuff. Now we can just focus on a kick-ass story involving the X-Men, these characters that you already know. And holy cow, if X-Men 2 didn't completely rock. Okay, that great, great movie. X-Men 3, you know, they got a little overconfident. They're resting on their laurels. They think they can coast through an X-Men 3. I don't know what they did wrong, but it was terrible. Hated X-Men 3. Wolverine, okay, everyone else in the world hated Wolverine. I really, really enjoyed that. I mean, I recognize that it is a terrible movie from a lot of different standpoints. But I really enjoyed watching Wolverine. I thought it was great. Maybe this, I saw it in the theater with my wife, which is the best way to watch any movie. Always gains an extra half star at least just because I'm in a theater with my wife. But I enjoyed Wolverine. But now, X-Men First Class, I didn't just enjoy it. It was also, objectively, a great film. You know, even without it necessarily being a superhero movie, it was just a great story. All right. First off, the acting was awesome. All right, Kevin Bacon. I am not a huge fan of Sebastian Shaw. The Black King has just never been one of my favorites. You know, just the way it goes. But you put Kevin Bacon in that role, and that man rocked it. All right, he was evil. He was really evil, and I enjoyed that. And I liked Magneto. I liked Xavier. I liked the way they Magneto. The movie is really, really, it's about Xavier and Magneto's origin story. I mean, as much as it's X-Men First Class and it's really an origin story of the X-Men itself, whatever. It's really about these two guys, all right? And for them to get to the end of the movie and for me to like Xavier and Magneto both and yet see them at the end where their paths finally completely diverge and we get one good guy and one supervillain, and yet we believe them both and we understand them both and we get it. I'm just thrilled by that. I thought this version of Mystique was just incredible. Okay, not only is the actress really, really hot, Mystique's really, really hot. That's just the way the world works. But again, a well-developed character. Before, Mystique was, honestly, she was a throwaway character. And I mean, yeah, you know, I get that she did really well. I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on her name. Rebecca Romaine Stamos. Holy cow, I can't, not even Stamos anymore. Rebecca Romaine. I cannot believe I drew a blank on that. She was awesome as Mystique in the early movies. But Mystique had no character to her other than she was really cool and she looked great on screen and she did really, really awesome stuff. But there was no background to her, all right? She was a tool. She was a plot device so that Magneto could get into these places and Magneto could do this stuff. She was that convenient, all-purpose, you know, Doctor Who, cosmic screwdriver garbage thing that you basically just gets you where you need to be in the story and looks good doing it. But now she turns into a real character with real motivations and real issues, and I loved her. I thought she was wonderful. And her choice at the end, you know, obviously needed to be done, but made perfect sense in context. They worked it really, really well. And then, of course, for this movie, they then had to add in whoever the teleporting demon dude is, Nightcrawler's dad. They added him in, and he became the guy with absolutely no background and no personality, and he was just the tool that essentially got Magneto in and out of places and wherever he needed. And actually, to a lesser degree, even Emma Frost did the same thing. That was actually, if I had to have one bit of disappointment in this film, it was the Emma Frost character. She was honestly just there because, well, the Black King's... did I say Magneto earlier? I was talking about Black King in this part. But anyway. Because Sebastian Shaw needed a telepath on his team to balance out Xavier, this is where they went ahead and took Emma Frost and made her the telepath, even though through continuity, I'm sure Emma Frost showed up. I know she did. Showed up in Wolverine. And she showed up in Wolverine when Cyclops was young, so it would have had to have taken place, you know, that would have had to be 15 years after this movie, and yet Emma Frost was younger in the later movie than she was 15 years earlier in this movie, and it just, the whole thing just didn't work for me with Emma. I mean, she was cool, again, she was cool, she was hot, she did great stuff on screen, but the little continuity error bothered me about her. I wish, you know what, I am so rambling enough about that. This was a great movie. Holy cow. So, having just derailed myself, I absolutely have not a thought in my head other than, you should watch X-Men. If you haven't watched X-Men First Class, and I know all of you have, but if you haven't, you should go do that. Very cool. But the second movie I'm going to cover, a little movie that I just discovered called Die Hard. Have any of you seen this yet? Oh my God, this thing's great. I, about 6 months ago, went back and watched Die Hard again probably the 10th time I've watched Die Hard. I don't know. I watched Die Hard again with my two oldest sons because they'd never seen Die Hard. There's lots of references to it in popular culture. It's just something that you have to watch, right? And I am amazed, and I just watched it again about a week ago. I am amazed that Die Hard, for being, how old is that movie now? 20 years? 25 years? 30 even? I don't remember. I'm 25 years old. That movie holds up perfectly. There is nothing wrong with Die Hard. I fully expected that, you know, going back when I watched it with my kids, I hadn't seen Die Hard in 10 years maybe, right? And so I was fully expecting that it would not have survived well, and not because of the movie itself, but because of all of its imitators. I mean, for how long? I mean, not just Die Hard 2, Die Hard 3, Die Hard 4, however many they've made now, but, you know, every Jean-Claude Van Damme, not even Van Damme, more Seagal. Every Steven Seagal film that was nothing but a Die Hard ripoff. I mean, how many Die Hard ripoffs did we have to make? You know, Passenger 57. I mean, these things went on forever. Every action movie had to be Die Hard at that point. Everything had to be the unsuspecting retired cop or retired military officer or retired whatever. There's some guy who used to be a hero. Now he's on his own time, and now he's caught up in circumstances that he just didn't, oh, whatever, okay. It's all the same stuff. And so I thought, after seeing 20, 30, 50, 100 of those, that Die Hard itself would maybe be a little worn out because the premise has been reused so many times, people have driven it into the dirt. But guess what? Die Hard was awesome. And here's how I know. It wasn't just my nostalgia. It was the fact that I got done, and my two kids, ages 16 and 13, they got done watching it, and they said, oh my God, that was the best thing ever. Yeah, I know. I told you it was. It blew them away. because Die Hard is really that good, and it stands the test of time. And so I'm not going to go on and on about Die Hard, other than to say I can't believe it held up so well. I can't believe that this treasure from my youth, I mean, it came out when I was in high school, that this thing is still as good as it is. Except to say that if you've never seen Die Hard before, if you're one of the younger listeners to the podcast, don't forget as you're watching it that the big bad guy is Snape. Yeah, yeah, you won't even recognize him, and you'll get halfway through, and you'll go, wait a minute, that's Snape? Are you kidding me? And then you'll hear the voice, and you'll go, oh, my God, I guess it is. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, Die Hard, awesome, awesome film. I'm so glad I revisited that, and I think if you haven't seen it in a while or if you've never seen it, for God's sake, go watch it. Go watch it again. It's great. Now it's time for a Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
Of course it's not, Gonzo, but you're very, very close. This is a Nerd Culture Report. Just random stuff that you just wouldn't expect. And in this time, Joel came into my office. I can't even remember why we brought up the topic of fan fiction, but Joel said, oh, I know why, because we were talking about different classifications of nerds. And there's a very old chart from a website called The Brunching Shuttlecocks. And brunching has been out of business for a long time. But, or at least last time I checked it was. But one of the things that they made that got passed around quite a bit was the geek hierarchy, geek organization chart. And essentially, it's the level of geeks starting from the coolest to the least cool within the geek world. So thus, anyone higher up on the list is allowed to make fun of, or regularly makes fun of, people lower down on the list. And ultimately, at the very bottom of the list is people who write bad, furry Star Trek fan fiction, you know, where Kirk is an ocelot or something, and then they put themselves in as a Mary Sue character who gets to be the romantic love interest of the Kirk ocelot, blah, blah, blah. All right, anyway, it's a very funny chart. You know, go look up Geek Hierarchy. You'll find it. It's pretty easy. But we got to talking about fan fiction, and Joel said, oh, there's lower rungs of fan fiction than that. I said, really? Lower rungs than erotic, furry Star Trek fan fiction? He said, oh, absolutely. He said, have you ever seen pro wrestling fan fiction? What? Back to truck up for a minute. What? And apparently, there is a whole culture of pro wrestling fan fiction. You're kidding me. So I go look up, and you could go visit it yourself. Go to fanfiction.net, seriously. And actually, any topic you want to look up at fanfiction.net, you can find it. It's there, and people do it just for fun. They just write stories about anything for fun, and it's all there at fanfiction.net. And so you'll go in and look up wrestling. And my favorite, my absolute favorite, is And they take it seriously. They take it really, really seriously. All right. And so my favorite is I don't even know the guy's name who's writing it, but he writes fan fiction about The Undertaker, the pro wrestler The Undertaker, and the big bad guy is the Boogeyman in these stories. And all right, here let me give you a quick summary of The Undertaker. This is from Chapter 1 of The Undertaker. The author gives us a quick summary of who the character is. The Undertaker's real name is Mark Calloway. And he writes, when Mark Calloway was a child, a fire took the lives of him and his parents. However, something brought him back from the dead and gave him demonic powers, most notably the ability to return after being killed. Now he seeks to find out who or what killed his parents, as well as protect the innocent from the supernatural forces of evil. Oh. This is a great start already. And the guy says straight up that really this is more of a Batman type story, and he admits freely that, you know, many of his villains are copied straight from Batman villains. He's just given them different names and slightly different abilities. But essentially, what if the Undertaker was a version of Batman fueled by demonic fire? Okay, I guess you can't argue with that, right? So, I mean, it's brilliant stuff. All right, so I'm reading through, and I've read several chapters of The Undertaker's story, and let me give you just a little taste of one of my favorite moments. This is Undertaker is trapped in a dream, in a dream world inside his own head, and he is now confronting the Boogeyman being behind all of this. And here's where we start our quote. "Boogeyman," the Undertaker spat as he made his way to his feet. "This is a new trick for you, demon." The man gave a laugh. "Did you enjoy your little mind trip, dead man? Did this bring back memories for you? A troubled childhood moment, perhaps?" "How did you do this?" the Undertaker inquired. "How did you manage to get into my head?" "I believe I'll save that for another time. As of now, we have a journey to continue." The boogeyman raised his staff, and the house began to crumble and fall away. Only the piece of the floor that the Undertaker was standing on remained, as everything else seemed to be sucked into a vortex. Now his surroundings had changed again, replaced by some horrid variation of hell. The Undertaker looked around. He was now standing on a pillar, surrounded by various rock formations. The boogeyman, however, was nowhere in sight. The Undertaker leapt from one pillar to another, trying to make it to the nearest cliff, all the while taking in his new environment. This was not hell, per se, because the Undertaker had seen hell, but it was a close enough version of it. The skies were red with angry red clouds, flashing lightning down upon the Undertaker. Below him was a lake of fire, and every so often the Undertaker could hear the tortured screams of some poor soul somewhere out of his visual range. Brr, you feel the chills. It was good, right? I'm telling you, and it's all like that. My favorite line in all of this. "This was not hell per se, because the Undertaker had seen hell." Oh, that sums up everything you need to know about this story, right? Go check some of this stuff out. And I will tell you, it sounds like I'm doing this to mock pro wrestling fan fiction. And, okay, I am. But it's more than just mocking, all right? It's a loving mock. I'm lovingly poking the people who would write something like this. Because when it comes down to it, again, the guy makes no secret about what he's doing. It's not like he's pretending that this is, you know, the great American novel. He's not trying to write something profound. He just is writing a story that is fun for him. And he says straight up, "Look, I'm stealing these characters from pro wrestling, characters that are all trademarked, copyrighted, whatever. I'm stealing these characters from pro wrestling. I am stealing basic theme and story elements and villains wholesale from Batman." He says, "I'm doing all of that. I'm just writing a story that I'm enjoying writing, and that maybe some of you will enjoy reading." This is not, you know, he's clearly not in it for profit. He's not in it to do anything more with it than just write it and see if anyone enjoys it. That's it. I got to admire that. I really, really do. And I'm telling you, that was my Star Trek communicator. You go down to fanfiction.net, look around, you will be amazed at what you find. And there are some, here's the problem with it. Most fan fiction is really, really bad. It's really poor writing. It's horrible. Okay, at least with The Undertaker and The Boogeyman, all right, at least this guy, I'm not saying he's a great writer, but he writes well enough for pulp style sci-fi superhero stories, right? I mean, this is not terrible. He knows how to tell a story. He knows how to construct things. I mean, even in the sample I read, sure, there may be some things as an editor that I might nitpick, but I'm guessing he doesn't have an editor. He's just having fun. I guess it just tells me that the depths of nerd culture, the depths of geekery that we are capable of, continue to surprise me day after day. And I revel in this. I think this is just amazing. Go check it out. Try it for yourself. But first, get the little ones out of the room and make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage! Okay, I am making a new rule. I am setting it down in stone right now. If you are writing a science fiction movie that is set in the future, you are not, and I repeat, you are not allowed to simply ignore cell phones and GPS technology just because it's inconvenient to your plot. Do you understand me? All right, cell phones and GPS are a reality of the present day. And if you write a story that hinges on them not existing, if you write a story that couldn't exist if people remembered that they had cell phones and GPS, then guess what? You've written a crappy, crappy story, and you need to stop. All right? Or at the very least, if you're going to pretend that those things don't exist, if you're going to write them out of your story, then you better explain to me, and you better have a good reason that fits your theme for why you don't include this technology in your story, okay? Because otherwise, you're just lazy. Lazy, 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 and I am sick of it. Let me explain what I mean about this, all right? I just watched the movie In Time, which stars Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried, all right? already this movie has two awesome things going for it. All right? There's just, I don't know how you can complain about that. And it is a slick, stylized movie. It's got a very it's an elegant 1940s sort of feel, or maybe even Depression era sort of feel, but it's very elegant. It's very, even the poor people are dressed really well, really dapper by today's standards, okay? And so even when Justin Timberlake as a poor person shows up in the rich district and says something about not fitting in, and someone replies, well, not dressed like that. And I'm looking at it going, yeah, he's wearing a vest, for God's sake. I mean, he's a vest and a cap, and he's, I mean, to me, well, that would be your Sunday best, right? But no, this is all about the style. And so the movie has a lot of promise. The idea of In Time is that everyone has 25 years on the clock. And then when you hit your 21st birthday, your clock starts running down. You got one more year after that. And then your time is gone. And then once you run out of time, you're dead. So when you go to work, instead of earning money, your paycheck is paid out to you in time. So I go work a full shift, and when I check out at the end of my full shift, I've just earned myself another 16 hours. I work 8 hours to get myself another 16 or another 12 or however much they pay me. All right, so this is a great concept, beautiful concept, and Justin Timberlake is going to be our big hero. He is going to be our Robin Hood, who's going to rise up from the poor district and try and change things. And I can't argue with any of that. But the story is really clunky and is really poorly told, and sadly, it just doesn't come together. I mean, the whole thing is slick, and some of the action is really cool, and some of the clever twists I really enjoyed. But by the end of it, it just didn't thrill me the way it should have. And as I got to think about it afterwards, part of it to me is once they're on the run, really nobody can track them down. Everybody has it's built into their skin. You see the numbers with your time on it light up on the skin of your forearm. All right. So everyone has this technology built into their DNA or implanted in them or something that keeps track of their time. And when their time runs out, kills them. And if their time doesn't run out, keeps them perpetually 25 years old forever. All right. This is pretty advanced technology. That money tracking system, time tracking system in them, there's no GPS in that. There's no locator built in that you can just find a person when you need them. Nobody thought of doing that. Or even better yet, when we were going through a lot of this and we're running away and, oh God, I need to explain. How am I ever going to explain to Daddy what I've done? Says Amanda Seyfried. You don't have a cell phone? Honest to God, we have this kind of technology. This kind of genetic engineering we have, and it's not like, okay, I can get, you know, if Justin Timberlake had a cell phone in the early portion of the movie, his mom wouldn't have died, all right? If they had just had a darn cell phone, she wouldn't have died. But I'll get it. Okay, look, poor people don't have cell phones. They can't afford it. Not when your time is so precious. You can't afford to spend that on a monthly minute plan, right? Paying your minutes for minutes. Is that how it works? So, okay, I'll even give them that one. Poor people don't have cell phones. But rich people, hey, we saw inside the rich people's house. We saw inside their world, and guess what? They have everything. Why did she not have a cell phone? Why did no one have a cell phone in this movie? Killing me. All right, but that's not even the most egregious example of this. When I watched The Island, this is another one that reminds me a lot of In Time. The Island was, and I don't remember who the dude was, Scarlett Johansson. That's who I'm thinking of. Scarlett Johansson was the female lead in that one. And in The Island, we've got people who are being bred as just replacement clones, all right? So I'm being bred for my parts, and I live as pretty much a child inside this special complex. And then if the subscriber who I'm cloned from, if he needs a liver, well, then they kill me, take my liver, and go give it to him. That's what I'm here for. And now these clones are, a couple of them have broken out, and they're trying to figure out a way to bring the system down, and blah, blah. Okay. All of that makes sense to me. Great premise. I loved the premise of it, and I thought it was a slick, well-developed world, and ready to go. My problem is, these clones, they pay... Clearly, the people who are rich enough in this world to afford clones pay millions upon millions of dollars for them. Millions. And yet, as valuable as this technology is, nobody ever thought to put a damn GPS tracker in any of them? Really? All right, same thing with iRobot. When I first, so, and I'm this whole GPS cell phone problem is not original to me. All right, the first time I heard someone mention it, it was in the context of iRobot. And again, iRobot, the whole premise here is that we've got a runaway robot. We've got a robot that has taken off on his own, and we need to find him. Honest to God, we spend thousands, tens of thousands, millions of dollars on these robots, and not a single one of them has a damn GPS tracker in them? Are you kidding me? This is the thing that I have a problem with, all right? And so it's not just these movies. It is also the movie AI, all right? We have rogue robots all over the place in AI, all right? It's clearly a culture of robots who have gone rogue, escaped, or been thrown away, and now they're on their own causing trouble. And again, no one thought to put a GPS tracker on any of these. Or the movie, what's the one I just saw? Repo Men. All right, I saw Repo Men. Again, great premise. But, you know, here's a company that creates artificial organs for people, and then they charge exorbitant prices, and when you can't make your payment, and people ultimately can't make their payment, then we come for you, and we repossess your organ. But we rely on these repo men who are essentially bounty hunters tracking these people down. Really, the organs are that valuable, and our business model revolves around pricing them out of people's range, sucking them dry for every penny they have, and then taking the organ back and reselling it. That is our business model as explicitly stated in the film, and yet we actually have to go find people and track them down. Oh, well, he's not at home. I don't know where he could have gone. We didn't put a GPS tracking unit in any of those organs? Are you kidding? I keep saying that, but it's true. It just drives me nuts. And so, to me, if you can't account for cell phone technology or GPS technology within your story, then don't write it, all right? You're stupid, and you don't deserve to have your story made into a movie, because honestly, I can't see it anymore. All right, I used to be able to just gloss over that stuff because I'm willing to buy into stuff. All right, I'm very easy when it comes to accepting any far-fetched premise in a movie. But now it's gotten to the point where if you can't even account for those little things, then I can't watch anymore. It just drives me crazy anymore. I can't do it. I mean, even look, horror movies do. You know why? Because in horror movies, they're usually set in the in present day, and thus people who are watching it in present day expect that everyone in the world has a cell phone. And so if your cell phone isn't going to work in a horror movie, if it's a situation where, you know what, if I just called somebody, we'd have this solved in no time. And so horror movies account for that. They always, you know, if they need to account for it, then they have some scene early on in which the person's cell phone gets destroyed. Or they, even better, set it out in a remote location where I don't get cell signal. Oh, no. Which, you know, 10 years from now, you're not even going to be able to use that as an excuse, because 10 years from now we'll suddenly be in a situation where every place in the world has cell signal. Or we're trapped inside a dungeon or a secret lab or a base somewhere where they must be blocking cells. All right, I can't get any reception in here. I don't know what's going on. All right, that all makes perfect sense to me. Horror movies, cheap, horrible, lazy horror movies are smart enough to account for the fact that people have cell phones. You can't do it as a science fiction writer, honestly? Then give up. Stop writing. Okay, I've raged enough, haven't I? Why don't we move on to a little bit of music?
This is when the party ends. I can't stand here listening. This is where the party ends. I just sit here wondering how you stand by your aces.
love that song, but one is not enough. I will explain in a minute. Here's another one.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle man.
Okay, those two songs were Your Racist Friend and Particle Man, both by They Might Be Giants, and both off of their Flood album, which was the first They Might Be Giants album that I bought way back in 1989, I think. No, 1990. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. I love They Might Be Giants. I saw when I was living I just moved into my own apartment in college, and I was watching MTV, and on MTV they played Birdhouse in Your Soul by They Might Be Giants. Still one of my favorite Giants songs. And I fell in love, absolutely fell in love. And so I went out and I bought their current album, Flood. It was their third album. And I listened to it all the way through and I thought, wow, except for Birdhouse in Your Soul, this music really sucks. And then I listened to it again and went, oh, wait, no, there's a couple ones. You know, because they are quirky, alternative, edgy, and listening to that first album, Flood, well, their third, but first for me, listening to that first album, I was surprised that they had some songs that were a little bit country, some songs that were a little bit rock, some of them that were just really sparse, odd choices, one that was mostly sound effects. It was just weird. They were really experimental. And after listening to it a couple times through, I finally realized, oh, wait, no. It just, I didn't like it because it was different, because it wasn't something I was used to. My brain wasn't wired for it. And then I realized that, no, this is really good stuff. I fell in love with it. It became my favorite album for a long time. And then I bought another one of their albums, and then I borrowed a mixtape from a friend that had songs from all three of their first albums on it. And I was lost in They Might Be Giants at that point. And now, this is, what am I working on, 20 years later, 21 years later, I now have over 300 They Might Be Giants songs to choose from in my iTunes. And so therefore, I'm having to double up on my usual twofer. So I gave you two of them to open up with, and I will move into two more in just a minute. But the reason I'm doing They Might Be Giants this week is because I just went to see them live in concert in Omaha. I was thrilled. This is the second time I've seen them in concert. The first time was 3 years ago for my birthday. My wife took me, and we had a blast. And so we went and see them again, and they just do a great live show. And this time, my only complaint is we were sitting up in the balcony this time. It's in a place called The Slowdown in Omaha, so it's a bar, essentially. But they have music pretty much every night of the week. And so, you know, it's only a venue for about 500 people, 600 people. It's not huge. And so if you sit up in the balcony, you're actually really close to the stage from up there. And I don't know if it was because that's where we were and the speakers were mounted up high and they were aimed right at us, or if it was just louder than last time, but the music was so loud. It was so loud that there was a bit of distortion in it, and especially for the opening band, which was a band called Gold Motel, and they were pretty good, but especially for the opening band, but also for They Might Be Giants, couldn't make out a lot of the lyrics. It was just hard to hear sometimes. And so now, of course, it wasn't a problem for me because, well, I know all of the lyrics, and so therefore I didn't have much of a problem. I knew what they were saying all the way through, and I had a great time. Great time. But we brought along my son Gygax and his friend McDiddles, and the two of them, well, Gygax actually knows most of the songs too, but McDiddles only knew like three or four of them, maybe five, before we got there. And so for him, some of it was maybe a little strained. I feel bad for him. I don't think he got the full experience. But I had a great time. And because of that, I was reminded of how much I love They Might Be Giants and realized I got to do something for them here. I know they've been around for 30 years, and they've got, you know, a lot of my favorites are stuff that is old. It's, you know, 20, 30 years old at this point. But I can't help it. I got to share it with you. If you've never listened to They Might Be Giants, I highly recommend them. I just can't say enough. But before we get to more music, It's time for the word of the week.
What are words for when no one listens anymore? Words for when no one listens, what are words for?
And this week's word is penultimate. Penultimate. All right, it's like ultimate, except with P-E-N, pen, on the front of it. And this is a word that my dad actually taught me, you know, 20 years ago. More than that, 30 years ago, when I was in high school. Anyway, penultimate means second to last. I just thought that's spectacular. Seriously, second to last? That they have an actual word for that. I think that's great. Penultimate, just before the end. And I've always... I can't remember why he brought it to me. I can't remember why he used it in conversation or brought it up, but he specifically sat me down and defined it for me so that I could use it in conversation, and I have many times since then. I love the word penultimate. It is incredibly useful. And so therefore, your mission, whether you choose to accept it or not, is to use penultimate. Use it in casual conversation, all right? Use it in something that you're writing. Better yet, go visit our forums and use it there. That will, A, prove that you listen to the podcast, and B, show that you can apply the knowledge that you gain. That's always worth your time. So, penultimate, that's your new word. Go out, make it yours. And now, the badass movie quote of the week. This week, you're getting a twofer. All right, I went to pick up this quote, and I saw another one from the same movie that's not as badass, but it is funny and needs to be shared. So both of these are from the same scene, in fact. Let me give you the first one. As the hero runs across a gorgeous woman, turns to the guy next to him, and says, "Have you ever seen a body like this before in your life?" "She happens to be my daughter." "Oh, well then I guess you have." All right, that is Val Kilmer as Chris Knight, and Ed Lauder as the girl's father, from the movie Real Genius. And I love the movie Real Genius. I think it's on instant watch right now. I have been meaning to go back and watch it with my kids because it's one of my favorites from high school and college. I had a friend who literally was Val Kilmer from this movie when Val Kilmer was young and studly. And he even, according to his story, he stole the movie box, not the movie itself, but just the box for it. He stole it from his local video store, took the box down to his barber and said, "I want my hair cut like this." And that's what he got. And he looked amazingly like Val Kilmer. But anyway, from later in that exact same scene, Chris Knight, our hero, is now hitting on said hot woman. And he says, "So if there's anything I can do for you, or more to the point, to you, you just let me know. Can you hammer a 6-inch spike through a board with your penis?" "Not right now." Girl's got to have her standards. Love that. That's badass. That is the best way to shoot it down. And she just walks out of the scene after that. That was awesome. And that was, in fact, all right, Val Kilmer is Chris Knight again. And the girl Susan was played by Deborah Foreman. Deborah Foreman, who already mentioned the movie Valley Girl. She was the Valley Girl from the movie Valley Girl. Which also starred Uber Geek Nick Cage. There you go. Let's get a little more music in here. This is two more from They Might Be Giants, and the first one is off of their, I was going to say newest album, but as it turns out, the night of the concert, they had another album drop. I mean, literally, the album was released onto iTunes that day while we were at the concert, and I bought that one too, and I've given it the new album, newest album. They have their cover version of Tub Thumping on there. Oh, I love that. But I'm not going to play that one. This is from the album, the penultimate album for them. It would be the song Spoiler Alert. Give it a listen.
This truck has a mind of its own,
nearing
which is the last cage thing,
and the
cause
end of
my
the
leg
book
is so short that I can't reach the brake.
Yeah,
what this truck is driving
out
of my mind.
should
but this truck
driving?
Has a mind
while
of its
I'm
own.
Driving
which
while I'm making
a
phone call
thing,
while I'm searching for
my
love box while I'm
is
writing
so short
it all down,
that I can't
while it's
reach
happening.
The break.
They're gonna be so
and I've got some commentary on Spoiler Alert, but first, a taste, just a taste of the Mesopotamians.
We've been driving around from one end of this town to the other and back. But no one's ever seen us driving our Econoline van. And no one's ever heard of our band. We're the Mesopotamians. Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Apal, and Gilgamesh. And they wouldn't understand a word we say, so we'll scratch it all down into the clay. Half believing there will sometime come a day someone gives a damn. Maybe when the concrete has crumbled to sand, we're the Mesopotamians. Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Apal, and the Mesopotamish sun is beating down.
Oh, that's great stuff. See, Mesopotamians is, they might be giants, introducing science and history and learning into their songs, which is not as pretentious as it sounds, I swear. It's actually fun. And I'm not even going to give you a list of all the songs where they do this, but they're just really good at this. My commentary on Spoiler Alert, that song is the two voices singing, one from each speaker, and they, as far as I can tell, are singing completely different lyrics throughout the entire song. I mean, it's as if they have two storylines going on at the same time, and they just happen to be singing at the same time. When we saw them live a couple of days ago, they actually performed it with hand puppets, sock puppets, in front of a big screen, and it was really, really cool. But I love They Might Be Giants. I recommend you go out and check them out. I can't say enough about it. It's time to move on. We need to get to the Pod-O-Matic. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from? That is where you come in. You want to hear me babble on about something? Send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And thank you. I asked for more last time. You guys kept them coming. I got another 20 or so to add in. Still need more, but I appreciate it. Thank you so much. R2 has rolled us up a 31, and this comes from, Billy Bob again. Billy Bob says, tell us a story about living in Japan. Did I ever tell you I lived in Japan? I cannot remember that. See, now this is making me suspect that Billy Bob is somebody I know, or somebody from the old boards, or someone from... That's weird. Well, Billy Bob, stranger, living in Japan, my parents lived there for several years, as did my brothers. My next younger brother, the penultimate son in our house, graduated there from high school before coming to college in Nebraska. But I got to stay there for 3 months when they first moved there, and then I came back and visited for Christmas and vacations and stuff like that. So I can't really say that I lived in Japan necessarily. I mean, that first 3 months, but really we were on the airbase. We were just getting settled in. It wasn't until I came back for vacations and I'd spend a week there at Thanksgiving or whatever, or Christmas. That was when I got a real taste of it, because my brothers had been living there forever, and they knew all the stuff, and they could take me out, and we could go on the subways, and we could hit the clubs, and we could go shopping, and we could do all sorts of really cool stuff. And I don't have great stories about Japan necessarily, but I got a couple. One, and this was just an interesting fact of being in Japan as a white dude back in, this is 20 years ago, is that, one, you're taller than everybody. All right, I'm 6 foot tall, so I'm not huge, but I am tall. All right. And when you're in Japan, well, that made me, you know, a good 4 to 6 inches taller than everybody. Everybody. So really convenient part of this is if we're in a crowded intersection somewhere and there's literally thousands of people milling all over the place, if I want to find my brother, I just turn around and look, and guess what? His is the only head rising above the crowd. That was easy. My wife, who was then my fiance, got to travel to Japan with me the one time, and she just, it was funny. The first time we went downtown and we were mixing with the crowds of Japanese people, and my wife got to walk around going, "I'm so tall, I'm so tall." She was so happy because my wife is 5'4", and she's not huge by any standard. She is a short woman, well, average short. And for her, for the first time in her life, she towered over people. She was taller than lots of people in Japan. It was really cool. So that's part one of that. But as a result, not just the height and the size. We were not just taller, but bigger in general. And we also, as white Americans, were more boisterous than the typical Japanese by a long shot. So when we're mixing it up out in public, you know, when we're riding the subways, when we're walking down the street, we're loud. We are just inherently loud people, and not in a rude way, not like we were picking on anybody, not like we were causing trouble, but that's just how we talk. So we are huge, we're extremely loud, and we're speaking to each other in a language that most of the people around us don't understand, that they have no idea what we're saying. And so therefore, everywhere you go, you just get used to being treated by the Japanese the way white people in America stereotypically treat black people. That kind of, well, I don't want to be rude, and I'm not trying to be racist or stereotyped, but, you know, I may cross to the other side of the street. Or, you know what, I'm going to give up my seat here on the train and just move down to the other end. I'm not, you know, not because I'm racist, I'd be more comfortable over here, really. As I drive by, I'm going to lock the doors just in case. And it was just odd. And not, I mean, again, I don't want to compare our experience in Japan too heavily to the black experience in America because, again, we were privileged white kids living on an American airbase, you know, young people wanting for nothing, really. We were just out having fun. But it was just interesting. Just interesting. The language barrier worked to our advantage at times. My cousin lived out there, and he drove a van for the local rec center as just part of his job. He was a general handyman maintenance guy, and he got to drive the van around, and he picked up supplies and did all sorts of stuff for him. And while driving in Japan is just nuts, just crazy, because all the streets are way narrower than you would think of. I mean, we're talking blind corners because the buildings, there's no sidewalk. The buildings end at the curb, so you have road building. There's nothing in between the two. And so when you pull up to an intersection in a crowded residential or business neighborhood, doesn't make any difference, you can't see around the corners because there's a building there that goes right to the edge of the street, right into the corner. And so they actually have to mount huge reflective mirrors. You know the ones that they put at the back of the 7-Eleven, those big convex mirrors that let them see shoplifters at the back of the store? Yeah, they mount those suckers up high at intersections so that you can see around the corner. It's just unreal. Weird stuff. Trying to think of what else while we're in Japan. I was telling a story about my cousin. So anyway, while driving there, not to get sidetracked, he developed what we call the no-honk method of lane changing. This was awesome. That essentially, things are crowded, they're closely packed, and he's driving this big, awkward van, and he's not that great a driver to start with. And so therefore, if you need to change lanes, well, you put on your signal, that's great. You try and look over your shoulder, check your blind spots, but you can't see anything. So then you just start to slowly creep over, all right? Just inches at a time into the next lane. And eventually, you'll have your tires fully over the line into the next lane. And by that point, if nobody has honked at you, you must be clear. Go ahead and move on in. If someone honks, well, get back in your lane and stay there until you can get another chance. There you go, the no-honk method. And what this also entailed is that he got pulled over quite a bit. I told you, he's a bad driver. And as he found out, and I don't recommend this to anybody, because it's certainly deceptive and breaking the law, but It was really funny. When he'd get pulled over, you just waited for the cop to come back, and here comes the Japanese cop, and he'll come and he'll start talking to you. And then he needs to go back to his car to get something. And so he'll tell you to wait here, all right? Maybe you've showed him your license at this point. Maybe you've pulled out your vehicle information. Who knows what? But now he needs to go back to his vehicle. He tells you to wait here. Or at least you assume that's what he's saying. All right. And so as soon as the guy starts to walk back to his police car, my cousin just starts driving away. And invariably, the cop comes running back. No, 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 no. And starts instructing him again. And clearly he's telling him, wait here. Wait here. I will be right back. To which you just politely nod and smile. Okay. Uh-huh. You bet. Thanks. And then as soon as he walks away, you start driving off again. No, 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 no. Wait. Wait. Okay. After about the third time, the cop just lets you go because it's really not worth his time at this point. So, that's some cool. You know what? I just realized, I guess I said I didn't have any Japan stories. I guess I got a ton of them. I got a lot more, but we're going to end it right there. Number 73. That is way too many. I only have 70. So we're going to have to roll again. Thank you, R2. I'm starting to wonder if I might have to replace the dice in his Pot-O-Matic bubble because as the numbers start to dwindle, I've got two tens in there, so I'm getting a number from 1 to 100. Maybe that's too many for my Pot-O-Matic. We've been hovering right around 60 to 80 for a long time, but I hate to break it up because it's such a nice round number right now. Actually, right now the number is 17. Thank you, R2. This one is from Zimney Pot, and Zimney asks, what languages do you speak? English. That's it. I also know Pig Latin, and I know enough sign language and fingerspelling to not quite communicate with someone who is hearing impaired, but oh, I'm so close. All right. You know, my sign, I know maybe 30 or 40 signs well, and then I can fingerspell, but I can't do it fast enough to be useful. I mean, honestly, we might as well get a piece of paper and just write stuff down because we'll communicate way faster that way. But, you know, I know a little bit. I would love to know sign language. I would love to know other languages. I always feel so inferior when I talk to people in Europe who, you know, speak 3, 4, 12 languages each. I would love to know another language. And sign language actually would be American Sign would be my first choice if I had to learn another language. But after that, I don't really care. Spanish would probably be the most useful. I don't care. I would just like to know other languages. Number 36 from McDiddles. McDiddles says, I know you drink Diet Dr. Pepper. Oh, gosh. And today I'm not. By the way, I was out. So I've gotten a Cherry Coke Zero, which is not bad, but it's my wife's pop, and it's not really for me. But lacking my Diet Dr. Pepper, I have to do what I have to do. So I hope the quality of the podcast has not suffered because of the Cherry Coke Zero. Hopefully I'm still in good voice or as good as I ever get. Anyway, McDiddle says, I know you drink Diet Dr. Pepper, and even though I can't condone you pumping aspartame into your body, seriously, that stuff is horrible, I was wondering what you think about the new Dr. Pepper with only 10 calories. Okay, one, you're not going to get me to go off that easily. Sorry. Nice try, though. Second, I've tried it. Dr. Pepper 10, whatever they call it. It's all right. It tastes a lot like Diet Dr. Pepper. It's just a little bit off. Just a little bit not the same. And I'm figuring, to me, I understand their commercials. Honestly, the commercials I've seen for Dr. Pepper, the 10, is this isn't a drink for women. Clearly, women only drink diet drinks. That's girly stuff. If you want to be a real man, you drink 10 calories, which means I add all the aspartame that I usually did and then just a little bit of sugar, I guess. To me, it's a gimmick, just like Pepsi One, just like any of these others. I don't care. I like my Diet Dr. Pepper. I love my Diet Dr. Pepper. And it's still going to be around in 5 years or 10 years, whereas the 10-calorie Dr. Pepper, no, it won't be. It's going to disappear just like the others. If I had it available, I would drink it. But it's never going to be my first choice. Number 27 from Scree. Scree says, what's up with elves? What's your favorite type? Christmas elves? Tolkien elves? All right, one. All right, elves are incredibly popular. And elves started, I'm not going to give you the whole lecture on this kind of leprechaun, elf, boogeyman, goblin, dwarf, myth. All right. But all cultures have little people that do things, usually mischievous, possibly outright evil, dangerous. Everybody's got elves of some sort in their culture. And we have, through modernization, as we've evolved the stories, we've differentiated them so that, you know, the Scandinavian dwarves become, you know, the dwarves like you'd picture from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, or Gimli, or somebody like that. The elves have become something completely else, all right, rather than being the original house spirits that they may once have been. Although, let me correct that. Harry Potter has kept house elves, which is not a bad representation. But there's also, goblins, leprechauns, bugbears, boogeymen, they're all the same thing. They all started from the same basic concept, and then they each get their own regional flavor, and then from that, fiction, literature, myth has evolved them into the things we see today. So we've got house elves from Harry Potter. We've got Christmas elves, which are pretty close to house elves. We're talking, half-sized elves with pointy ears, usually who are quite helpful around the house. But from that, you move to Tolkien's elves, which started this trend of, no, elves are something more man-sized, man-like. And while I have a problem with Tolkien's elves because they're so perfect, and so, they were designed by Tolkien to be supermen. They were designed to be something completely else, something human but more so. All right, I get it. You know, they're taller, stronger, longer-lived, smarter, more magically capable, more everything. They're too perfect. I can't stand Tolkien's elves because of them being too perfect. D&D elves took the same concept of Tolkien's elves, except for some reason decided to make them shorter. D&D said, yeah, okay, you know, we like Tolkien's elves, but they're making us feel a little inferior. Can you make them 5 foot tall? Would that work? And so that's what they did. Whereas Pathfinder, which is the version of Dungeons & Dragons I play, Pathfinder has actually taken it back to... Yeah, elves are now, 6.5 foot tall again. They're tall. Thinner, but tall. Big. I like that. Shadowrun did the same thing with their elves. 6'6", that's a good height for an elf, right? And that's probably, if I have to pick my favorite elf, that's probably my favorite, is the Pathfinder Shadowrun types. The kinds that, still magically inclined, maybe a little... they have that forest-dwelling nature to them, although they don't necessarily have to be all back-to-nature types, but they have that tendency, that inkling. And taller but thinner than humans, really, it's still an improved human version, but a little more eccentric, a little more carefree. I don't know. Elves are not my favorite character to play, so I don't think about them as much as I would, say, a troll or an orc or a dwarf or a gnome. Elves are... one of my least favorites of the standard races that come with every single game you get. The elf or elf type is usually about my last choice. That's just the way I go. Number 66. Whew. All right, right towards the end of the list. This one is from Brasky. Brasky says, your wife just gave birth to a child. You have to name it after the secret identity of a comic book hero taking both the first and last names as first and middle name for your kid. What do you choose if it's a boy? What do you choose if it's a girl? All right. First off, Brasky apparently knows me because he knows I have already done this. My fourth son, who I usually refer to on the podcast as Tada, to protect his anonymity, Tada's actual name is Steve Rogers Jones, after Captain America. Because it was... All right, it's a long story, but we named him Steve. Really, we say after my friend Steve from high school and college, who Steve was my best friend for years and years. And we say we named him after him, but then we also threw in the middle name Rogers because, well, who doesn't love Captain America? Now, having seen the new Captain America movie, I am completely justified in my choice. Thank you, people at Marvel. Although I also do know somebody who has named, actually he named both of his kids with fictional character names, but one of them is named after a superhero, Hank McCoy, Beast from the X-Men. And I always thought that was pretty cool too. So, but if it was a girl, and I have not given as much thought to this because I don't have girls, I've only ever had boys, and would never know what to do if I had a girl. But I suppose, my first inclination is to go with to go with Supergirl and name her Kara Zor-El, Kara being a first name, which is a great first name. Kara, it's good. Zor-El as a middle name, like Kal-El for Superman, Zor-El, great middle name, because who cares about middle names? You're just there for flavor, right? So Kara Zor-El Jones. I like that. But because of that damnable Nick Cage naming his son Kal-El and getting so much flack for it, I think even as a middle name, I think it would be a little too much. My second choice would be Moxie Crime Fighter, but since that's not a superhero secret identity, it's a toss-up for me. I like Barbara Gordon because I like Oracle and I like Batgirl. But Barbara is really kind of a dated name. It's an old woman's name now. It was once classy and fashionable. It's not anymore. I can't really go with Barbara Gordon as much as I would like to. So therefore, I think, despite my complaints in the movie review, I'm going to go with Emma Frost. Emma Frost Jones. I think Emma is a beautiful name. It's getting kind of trendy and a little overpopular now, and I get that, and I will probably regret that decision, you know, when she's four or five and there's six Emmas in her class. But she'll be the only Emma Frost, and that'll be cool, right? Does that count, since it's not really a secret identity and she's not necessarily a hero, although she's been a good guy at times? I guess, I you know what, I'm going to let that one go. Emma Frost, that's my answer. I'm sticking with it. R2 tells me the next one is 43. From, we've still got one from Anonymous in here. Anonymous says, best comic book movie ever. And he spells it in all caps, E-V-A-R, ever. Because he still does that. Anonymous is so 2009, honestly. But best comic book movie ever. I can't believe I haven't talked about it. Have I not talked about this? I'm sure I have. Scott Pilgrim. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. I love Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. That's a great comic book movie. And here's the thing about it, is I watched Scott Pilgrim, the movie, and I fell in love. I thought it was awesome, incredible, knocked me out. And then I read the books. I read all of them, and I realized that, oh, God, the movie's not that good. I mean, it is for what it is, all right? The movie is really spectacular. It's really cleverly done. It is smart. It is so full of geek references, I can't even stand it. It trips every trigger I've got, and I love the movie. It's great. And in fact, I would like to watch it again. I've just never gotten around to it. But I saw it in the theater, had a great time with it. And then I read the books, and I realized, wow, it's so much better. The books are just phenomenal. Really, to take the same concepts as you've got in the movie, and yet to flesh them out and to make them real, and to, rather than having this relationship that runs just the course of a movie, this relationship that seems to, you know, begin, flourish, go through these stages, finally come to our realizations and conclusions at the end. All of that seems to happen in the movie in the matter of, you know, a month. And yet, in the books, they actually flesh that out over time. They have the space to really make it a real relationship between real people in this bizarre fictional world. And it's just wonderful. I absolutely love Scott Pilgrim. And if you enjoyed the movie as much as I did and you haven't read the books, go do it, because you will like that even better, I promise you. Number 64 is from Brasky again. Brasky says, what's the greatest zombie cinema game you've played? Give gory and fantastic details. Ho, you know how much I love this. Has to be someone. All right, you know how much I love zombie cinema. All right? Zombie cinema is a game, it's a role-playing game that is, you play out a zombie movie. That's all you do. And there is no game master to it. You come up with, you draw cards to construct really sketchy characters, basic zombie movie stereotype kind of characters. And then you take turns setting scenes and creating conflicts and rolling some dice. And the zombies have this little track where they slowly move up in the course of your story. Every time you guys screw up something too badly, the zombies get to move up. And so at first they're just rumors or whispers or TV news reports. Okay, but then at the next level they start showing up in the story and you have to account for that. And at the next level they get a little stronger, a little faster, until finally by the end zombies have completely taken over the world and they're gone. And so your trick is to stay ahead of the zombies on that track. And if you can get all the way to the top and out, you escape. You have a happy ending for yourself that you write into your movie. If the zombie level ever overtakes your space on this little track, guess what? You just got eaten. And now you get to play out a really dramatic I'm converted into a zombie scene for yourself. And it plays out so easily and so well. First time I ever played zombie cinema, we played it by accident. I was explaining the rules to my kids. We were in a car. We were driving somewhere, and I was trying to explain the rules to my kids. And as I'm explaining, I said, okay, well, for example, let's say that you're this character and you're this character. Okay, now let's say that we set a scene. Go ahead, set a scene. And I had one of them pretend. And we actually, by pretending, I mean, it was just to test the rules and say, hey, here's how it goes. As we played out the example, we realized, oh, my God, we're creating a real story. Holy crap, that was easy. And it was wonderful. We had, I mean, just doing that was cool. But we've played a few times since then. Never fails to be a good story. My absolute favorite, and I wish I could remember all of the fantastic and gory details, but it's been a while now. It was probably our first game that we played, and we wound up playing it in a courthouse. And so one of us was a judge, one of us was a smarmy lawyer, maybe someone was a prisoner who was in one of the cells. And as zombies start coming, you know, we start making, you know, deals with each other, and, hey, you can't leave us locked up in here. And so we start getting out. And they wound up, I wound up being, I was the smarmy dude. I was the guy on a cell phone, all right, the one in every zombie movie when you have the whole group, the big cast. I was the guy who's always on his cell phone, and I wound up sneaking away up to the judge's chambers, and I'm trying to make a call, and I'm trying to make a profit out of this, and I'm trying to find some angle on it. And zombies just came pouring in on me, and I got slaughtered. I mean, I was torn to pieces in no time. And because I was just I was a dick. I was a jerk to everybody in the story. And so quickly, they realized they hated me. And so when it came around time for my scene, and I wound up here alone hiding out, oh, they ganged up on me quick. And they found a way to dispatch me, and it worked, and I was dead. But by the end, the old judge... and I can't remember all the details, but the old judge and some young kid had escaped, and he's the last guy left. And he winds up getting out of the courthouse, and he's in a van, and he winds up wrecking his van at a gas station somewhere, and here come the zombies, and we have this really tense, dramatic scene. And I mean, the zombies are a mob now, a horrible, horrible mob. And he winds up, you know, kicking away, and him and this kid... He winds up throwing the kid on the back of a motorcycle. I don't remember where they got the motorcycle from. Convenient plot device. Who cares? But here he is. I mean, old judge on a Harley, little kid on the back. He's wielding a shotgun, blowing zombies away as he speeds off out of town. And he actually made it off the track, and he escaped. It was one of the few escapes we ever had. And No, it was the next one where the guy escaped. The guy escaped with a helicopter in the next game. No, in this one, the judge went down. Blaze of Glory went down. So here we had this huge final scene. Okay, imagine the whole thing I just explained. Shotgun, kid on the Harley, old judge driving. And imagine that he's making his final stand. And as he's blowing guys away, boom, gets dragged down and finally eaten. And, of course, zombies take over the world and we all lost. And it was awesome. It was awesome. I am, you know what, next time I get the guys together, I'm going to tell them, look, no Dungeons and Dragons, not this week. This time we are playing Zombie Cinema, whether you like it or not. I've gotten McDiddles to play Zombie Cinema once, but Will Halls could get in on this, Scree could get in on this. We got a chance to do this. We've got to play a game of Zombie Cinema somewhere, because it's easy. You can play it in a single setting, one night only, and you have as many people as you want, and boom. Story constructs itself. No preparation, no nothing. Off you go. I'm going to do this. I thank you, Brasky, for bringing it up. I so miss playing Zombie Cinema. I haven't played in ages. I'm going to do that. Anyway, this podcast is copyright 2011 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was by They Might Be Giants with Your Racist Friend, Particle Man, Spoiler Alert, and the Mesopotamians. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys' Sabotage, as performed by the Penelopes. The bumper clips this week are taken from Everything Right Is Wrong Again by They Might Be Giants, Richard O'Brien with Science Fiction Double Feature, and Words by Missing Persons. All bumper music, all music on this podcast is available on iTunes. Check it out. Buy their songs. I wouldn't put them in my show if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for the podcast, head over to iTunes and write a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up. Send me a message. Hang out. Ooh, have fun. Through the woods on a big blue ox. He had fists as hard as chopping blocks. 500 pounds and 9 feet tall. That's Paul. Talk about working. When he swung his axe, you could hear it ring for a mile and a half. And he'd yell, "Timber!" And down she'd fall. For Paul. Talk about drinking. That man's so mean, he'd never drink nothing but kerosene. And a 5-gallon can is a little bit small. For Paul. Talk about tough. Well, he once had a fight with a thunderstorm on a cold, dark night. I ain't saying who won, but it don't storm at all around here, thanks to Paul. He was 90 years old when he said with a sigh, "I think I'm going to lay down and die, because sunshine and sorrow, I've seen it all," says Paul. So he died, and we cried. Took 18 men just to bust the ground. Took 24 more just to lower them down. And we covered them up and we figured that was all for Paul. But late one night, the trees started shaking. The dogs started howling. The earth started quaking. And out of the ground with a "Hi, y'all, come Paul." He shook the dirt from off of his clothes, scratched his butt, and he wiped his nose. "You know, being dead weren't no fun at all," says Paul. So he jumps on his ox with a "Fare thee well," and he says, "I'll find out if they's trees in hell." And he rode away, and that was all we ever seen of Paul. But the next time you hear a timber yell, the sound like it's coming from the pits of hell, then a weird and devilish ghostly wail like somebody chopping on the devil's tail, then a shout and a call and a crash and a fall, well, that ain't no mortal man at all. That's Paul. Paul Bunyan by Shel Silverstein.